everybody. Thanks for joining us on the call for Freeburg Global Macro today. I'm happy to have David Rothberg and Albert Freeburg from the Freeburg Organization on the phone with us. Wanted to just give you a couple of guidelines for today's discussion. Number one, this call is being recorded, so if by chance you have to hop off early, there is a recording available, and I know all your friends and relatives are going to want to call in and listen, so it will be available by call-in. Also, there is going to be a question and answer session, so while you're listening to the call, please jot down your questions, and you know, we'd love to be able to take whatever questions you have coming our way. I want to congratulate Mr. Freeburg again on another fantastic year. The assets, by the way, in the Freeburg organization here in the funds are approximately $226 million. As many of you know, we've opened up a new feeder fund for the Freeburg, which is now open and ready to go in terms of what funds are available. The returns this year were great. Had a net return of up 11.7 for 2006 with well-contained risk. And I think the biggest drawdown was about 1.8. So again, another great year for the Freeburg organization. As many of you know, Mr. Freeburg is a brilliant economist and a manager of the Global Macro Fund. He's been in the market for many, many years and is a true market warrior and a true market scholar. The Global Macro Fund has just completed its fifth year, and we are going to talk about what's happened in the fund and where we're going. And to lead that discussion, I'm going to turn the call over to David Rothberg.
Thanks very much, Brad. Okay, Al, let's get right to it if we could. You had a very good quarter. You were up 6% on the quarter, and as Brad said, you accomplished it with very small volatility, very low volatility, very slight drawdowns. The money was made in the commodity section, long the wheat, short the copper, and still being bearish in the oil roll position you've had for nearly 2 years. In the currency section, you made money long long Brazil versus Mexico, long British versus Euro. You were short some Canada. The tips were rather rude to you in consideration of your fealty to them for the last 5 years. Lost, I think, 1%. But the majority of the money was made being long the stock market via S&P futures contracts. You exposed the fund notionally to three-quarters risk by buying S&P futures. And yet, towards the end of the quarter, you made quite a radical reversal in the portfolio. Got bearish in equities and generally much more bearish than you have been in commodities and on the world generally, in the asset market generally. Could we begin by your talking about how the portfolio morphed from the positions you had in the fourth quarter to the current view that you have going forward in 2007?
Okay, thank you very much. Good morning. Thanks, David. In response to your question, we began the quarter with a heavy position in S&P futures, and the idea was at the time that we took the position that we would be liquidating towards the end of the year. It was primarily a bit of a contrarian trade. It was in view of the fact that the hedge fund community was negative generally in the market at the time, and that my sense was that this market would have a sort of like a final blow off towards the end of the year. We were fully conscious of the fact that profit margins were starting to get squeezed, and that would become visible sometime in January and February. So we reduced the position and actually eliminated the position between December the 24th and January the 3rd, and even began at the time to take a light short position in the S&P, of course much lighter than what our original long position was. It's sort of like a dipping a toe in the water just to get our feel of this market. At the same time, we began to purchase some of that very low volatility. We felt that the only bargain in today's market was volatility. So we began to buy a small position so far, but growing in put options. far out of the money put options. And in addition, I felt that the area of major, the area that has potentially the most to lose is the emerging market area. And I started doing a selective amount of selling or betting against the some of these markets, Russia by way of Lukoil puts, South Korea by way of selling the Kospi and maybe some with some options. And recently we put on a position that we are still building we're buying a bearish bet on Venezuelan debt. My feeling is that at 250 basis points or 260 points over treasuries for 10-year Venezuela, I believe it's a good way. The market is still not fully cognizant of the fact that Venezuela will eventually have to default on the debt. Oil prices are coming down. Reserves, even though they're large, will be needed to defend a currency that's extremely overvalued. I think everybody here knows that the official exchange rate is around 2,100 bolivars to the dollar. The black market is at 4,100, so the incentives for capital to move out are extraordinary. For the government to be able to hold the official rate, it will lose reserves at an increasing rate. Oil production in Venezuela is coming down. I believe that it's only a matter of time before the market recognizes this and we see credit default spreads widen to at least 500 or 600 basis points. So our view, our general view of the world is that we are in the early stages of a asset liquidation phase. It began with the housing market weakness. I'm not convinced that the housing market has bottomed yet. I believe that we are still some ways from the final bottom. I also believe that we are still some ways from the final bottom in the corporate sector in terms of profit margins. Labor costs are rising, continue to rise a little bit faster now. Labor is catching up. Pricing power remains fairly weak, and so margins have to get squeezed and will continue to get squeezed. And I think we're going to see some substantial downward revisions to expectations of profits in the next 6 to 9 months. So my picture of the world is one in which we should be now moving into an asset liquidation phase. This is probably going to be bullish for AAA, and there's maybe only 9 corporations that have a AAA, but when I say AAA, I mean mostly government bonds, treasuries. And we've been switching some of the tip positioning to more into nominal long-term bonds, treasuries. I'm feeling that perhaps the CPI will be affected negatively by the fall in oil prices, and so we're more likely to have an effect play in the nominal sector. I believe that both will do well, but nominals will do better than the index variety. And in short, that's really where we are today. And David, I'm back to you.
Okay, thank you. Does this mean that you see ongoing weakness in the energy sector?
Yes. We think that there's still ongoing weakness in the energy sector. OPEC has a vow to defend the price. I see this morning in Indonesia. The president of OPEC felt that $50 oil is unacceptable and that efforts will be made to shore up prices. It's entirely possible that OPEC will be able to cut back some production. It is a bit of a difficult and awkward type of of an operation, and not all countries, we know now for a long time, not all countries go along with the cuts. There's a lot of cheaters, and we're really not exactly, we don't exactly know what inventories are doing worldwide. We have a pretty good feeling, at least in the United States, where they are, and they're growing, but we don't know well what they are outside, but it is tending to affect the price. And of course, the weather is another very interesting thing. The weather, for the first time, the weather may play a major and fundamental role in geopolitics.
You're speaking about global warming, are you?
Not global warming, no. I'm not believing global warming, but the fact that it is warmer now, at least in the Northeast, the area that consumes a lot of oil and generally energy, it is warmer than it has been for quite some time. I don't know whether this is a trend or whether this area of the world is warming and some other areas not. Cooling, but the users of energy, the areas that are users of energy are not using as much energy, and I think that's making a big difference. So all around, OPEC will try to defend the price, and maybe eventually it will succeed. Now OPEC supplies are growing. It will take some time. It will be difficult, and along the way we might be able to see anyway $45 and $40 oil.
Before we get to some specific positions in different parts of the portfolio, I just want to circle back to a view that you held as recently as 3 months ago, and it's one that you held for the several years prior to that. It was that because of the Fed's creation of liquidity, there was really a surplus of it, and the way to play the market was to think of where the next asset bubble was going to take place as liquidity sought yield, searching in one place and then another. Have you abandoned that thesis? Are you now thinking that this asset liquidation is of a more macro or more universal type?
No, I think that remains a feature of the fiat system, of this money system that we have. It doesn't mean that it continues and that it's there all the time. It's a feature in that governments and central banks will act asymmetrically. They will provide a tremendous amount of liquidity and increasing amounts as economic slowdown becomes apparent or recessions take place. And I think that the next time we have a significant slowdown or a recession, we will once again see the central bank inject money at rates below equilibrium levels, so that overstimulates the economy, and the result is that we get bubbles, and we have seen this happen since 1990, 91, or 92, since the savings and loans collapse. Federal Reserve has come in, has lowered rates to exceed excessively, created booms, created a boom in Mexico, and then came the collapse, created a boom in Southeast Asia, and then came the collapse, created another boom, and then came the collapse in Russia. And then came the technology bull market, and so on. So, in the housing bull market of the early part of this century, this is something that will continue to happen as long as the production of money is in the hands of, let's call it, public functionaries, bureaucrats. Quote-unquote, almost politicians, basically. And the next time this will happen is, as I say, the next time that we are in very deep trouble, they will try to do the same thing. One thing that we have to be concerned with is what happened in Japan. We had a very strong boom in the 80s, and then the boom was pricked by a raise in interest rates by the Bank of Japan. I think they raised the rates to about 6%. Brought the boom to an end. But the liquidation of assets and debt, or the impending liquidation, was so slow and it was so persistent that the Central Bank of Japan, even with a zero interest rate policy, was not able to reflate. And 15 years later, we are still not able to get a positive number on CPI year over year. So there is a certain inability there's a perceived here inability of a central bank being able to reflate when the system is broken, when the transmission system is broken. The transmission system in this case would be the commercial banks. They lent and lent a lot of money, and their balance sheets deteriorated and became so deteriorated that they were not able to create the credit that the central bank wanted to create by providing high-powered money or base money.
Okay, let's deal with
just to finish that. So even though I say that it's a permanent feature of central banks that they will err on the downside and provide a lot of money and create this kind of asset booms that we have seen for the past 15 years, it is also possible that at some point that type of an operation will lose potency, as we saw with Bank of Japan. So we have to be careful of that.
Thank you. All right, so you're bearish on equities, especially equities in emerging markets. How do you feel about commodities, and do you have a take on where this new view you have of the world is going to play itself out in the foreign exchange market?
Yeah, commodities, I believe that commodities are still on a corrective phase. Many of these commodities were actually driven to levels that were far higher than they should have been driven, but they were driven there because of investment demand. I'm talking about base metals, copper. Copper now is in the process of correcting that. So between copper and crude oil and the surprising weakness in the grains, I say surprising because the wheat had fairly good fundamentals. The weakness in sugar, which is primarily that's related anyway to the energy sector today because of the production of ethanol. I believe that commodity prices are still heading lower. Your next question was
foreign exchange markets.
Well, we have held for the last 2 or 3 years a fairly benign view of the dollar, fairly constructive.
Of the U.S. dollar.
We have not been interested in selling it short. Everybody's been talking about this terrible problem, this current account problem. But the truth is that foreign liabilities of the U.S. as a percentage of GDP have held fairly stable, around 22%. And you know the net liability position of the U.S. is basically the counterpart of the accumulated current account deficit. The fact that it's held stable is probably because of valuation gains that we have had as the dollar got a little weaker. So I don't see the U.S. position as being still vulnerable. I mean, there are other countries that had greater current account deficit than it remained, and their currency remained stable, New Zealand, Spain. In general, I see the U.S. economy as still the strongest economy in the world, still the best economy in the world. From the point of view of investments, it's still probably the only place that you have safety in your investments in terms of legal safety, legal protection, with a couple of exceptions here and there in Europe. Transparency is probably the best in the U.S. Legal protection is still the best. So capital will continue to flow here and fund that current account deficit. So my view of the dollar is still good. I still think the dollar is okay. It may not be the strongest currency in the world, but it will not be the weakest. It's not a reason to be short. I don't see a reason to be short dollars. On the other hand, there's a few peripheral type of plays, and we've been in that area for the last 2 or 3 years in that space, which is really the cross, the crosses, the non-dollar crosses, and some of them are like we've been short the euro pound. By the way, this morning we're very happy to see that the euro pound is down to new low, 66.50, 66.55. We've been in this trade now for over a year. There are opportunities in that area, and I think there will continue to be some opportunities in that area, specialized crosses. We were long Brazil and short Mexico for a number of reasons, and for a long term, for the longest period almost, and it's done extremely well. There are some carry trades that make sense, and there are some carry trades that don't make sense. I'm sorry to say that we do not do we did not take advantage of the euro yen, which was like the great trade in terms of the big currencies or the major currencies, primarily because I wasn't really bullish on the euro, and so I didn't think in terms of the euro yen going to where it's gone, and I think it's really gone too far. But again, I'm not prepared to bet against it either. You know, it's been a strong trend, and I don't like to stand in front of it if I don't have a very strong reason why I should. As I say, the Canadian dollar for us was a very much a no-brainer. We went short a number of months ago. For us, the position had made a lot of sense. The terms of trade of Canada were deteriorating. Interest rate differentials were working against Canada. And more importantly, legislation was passed a number of years ago that allowed pension plans and register plans to expand their foreign assets from what used to be called the basket, the 25% basket, to 100%. And now, the market didn't. The owners of register plans and pension plans did not take advantage of that because the Canadian stock market actually outperformed foreign markets because of the heavy energy content. But as that began as that changed, and as the energy market began to weaken, and as the performance of the Canadian market began to fall behind the performance of, let's say, the U.S. and some of the foreign markets, we are now beginning to see many, and we're talking about billions and tens of billions and maybe even hundreds of billions of dollars that can seek refuge in other markets, and that is a continuous lid, acting as a continuous lid on the Canadian dollar. So I don't want to sound overly bearish after the market has already gone from 110 to 118, and so I don't want to make an enormously bearish case here, but in my view, the Canadian dollar still has downside, and as I say, it's operating under a lid, a continuous leakage that's there, and that will keep us from rallying too far, at least for now.
Now, for those of you who are calling from outside of Canada, I quote a recent article in a magazine called Investment Executive, which speaks to financial planners in Canada. A survey of those people indicated that the number one concern of Canadian retail investors was to find diversification from the Canadian economy and the Canadian stock market. So this may very well vindicate your views. All right, Al, I thank you for that. I think that's a rounded discussion of where you're at now, and perhaps it would be appropriate to open the phone lines and field some questions. Are you okay with that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Brad, do you have anything to add?
Thanks, David. Well, I think what I'm going to do is while our callers are pulling their questions together, I'm going to throw one question in before we take from the audience. The near-term bearishness is what I'm hearing here between the commodities and stocks and the like. I think my question is going to focus on time frame. This, in the sense, is there a time frame or a level that you're looking for this sort of bearishness to end? And then I'm going to add to that question, is there still a belief in long-term demand drivers for commodities based on growth and based on lack of sort of long, bigger surpluses that the U.S. has had in crude So do you still see the long-term demand drivers in place, and is there some timing element on how long you're going to be playing from the short side for commodities and stocks?
I don't know. I don't know. Right now, the best that I can see is near-term. We should be moving into some weakness, and I can't really tell how long this will be. Sometimes things develop in ways that you don't expect them to. I think most of the time they do. But many times we walk into situations that could have been ameliorated or could have changed, and then they turn out worse than they should have. I mean, even taking an extreme case, the Great Depression in the U.S., began in 1929, but major policy mistakes took place in 1930, end of 30 and the beginning of 31. It is conceivable that we could have gotten out of that problem, and it would have been a one-year recession or so, or something that, or even something like what happened in the early 20s and 21. And yet we made policy mistakes, and certain things happen, and then it got worse, and then it accelerated on the downside. So it's very difficult for me right now, as I'm beginning to take that bearish view, as I'm beginning to do that, to already look beyond that valley and say with precision that it's 4 months, and then I'm going to come back. I don't know where it's going to lead us. Right now, all I can see is that we've had huge excesses in emerging markets and in low quality credits in the U.S. even, and these excesses will need to be addressed. And how long it will take and what events will make that happen, we're not exactly sure. I talked about Venezuela being a case. Many people will say, well, Venezuela is only one. There's 20 countries. There's the BRIC countries. There's so many. There's so many other places that are doing well, and why should that make a difference? Well, again, I don't know. You know, Venezuela could make a difference to Bolivia, it could make a difference to Ecuador, it could make a difference to Argentina, and now suddenly you have four things. And it could make, and Russia could make a difference to somebody else. And so I can't, and I don't think we can, really know what the consequences or ramifications are of things that are happening today. We do know that we are working with a vulnerable system. And anything that happens can affect something that's so vulnerable as we are today.
Mm-hmm. All right, I don't want to hog the time. I'd like to open it up to other questions from the group. Thank you, Albert.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to move yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from line 230.
Yeah, Al? Yes. I was wondering if you could comment on gold, please.
Okay. The way we look at gold is this. We like to see gold, quote-unquote, act well, entirely independent of a supposed or entirely independent of U.S. dollar weakness. In other words, we are not happy with the case that one should buy gold because the dollar is going to be weak. First, because we don't think the dollar will be weak. We don't think the dollar should be weak. Secondly, because that's a very narrow view. If I thought that gold is going to get stronger because the dollar is weak, maybe I'm better off buying yen or euros or pounds than buying gold. I may do better. So we want to see gold actually move up on its own merits, and it did that in the first phase up from the 300 lows to the 700 peak. It basically moved up on its own without too much help. And in fact, sometimes as the U.S. dollar was getting strong, so that was an ideal sign for me that gold had past few months, more than that kind of strength. I've not seen that kind of independent strength. At the same time, I must confess that the gold market is acting better than many commodities, and it's outperformed oil by a fair margin. And so, from that point of view, gold is acting better, but still not good enough. So we feel that we are still in some sort of a base building mode. I still believe in the fundamentals, the long-term fundamentals, because production is starting to fall, and it's likely to fall more rapidly in the next few years. There's continuous consolidation in the business. Mining firms, large mining firms are absorbing smaller firms. They're trying to buy reserves in the market. When you see that, you know that it's cheaper to buy reserves in the market than to go and find reserves in the ground. Reserves in the ground are expensive. They're in politically sensitive areas and in politically difficult areas. So the production of gold is at least in my production of gold is in a decline. We know what happened with South Africa, which at one time produced over 1,000 tons of gold and now produces less than 300 tons of gold a year. And this is likely to happen to many parts of the world. So from that point of view, we have very favorable fundamentals. From the point of view of central bank selling, we've seen a lot of central bank selling in the past few years. Most central banks have already gotten down to the levels that they would like to see. And I think that at least for European countries, they have all decided that they want to have some percentage of the reserves in gold. So they have reduced positions, but they have maintained a minimum. Some countries have eliminated them all entirely, like Canada. But for the most part, central bank selling between the Basel Agreement, which was expanded to 15 countries, and the fact that years have gone by of gold liquidation by central banks, I think that we're getting to the point where supplies from that area are not going to be a problem going forward. Not going to be a problem of any sort going forward. If anything, Asian central banks that have accumulated very large U.S. dollar reserves are likely to consider, I think, likely to consider at some point diversifying assets and looking at things like gold. Some central banks may be more interested in purchasing commodities that they think that they need, strategic commodities. But there may be some that will be interested in gold and as part of a package, let's say. And it's not easy to purchase the quantities. These countries have very large reserves. If they move to 10% of their reserves in gold, you're talking about an astronomical amount of gold to be bought. I imagine that if such a thing were to happen, they would need to contact, let's say, the BIS, and make a deal with the BIS, whereby they would absorb the planned selling of the European central banks, try to make some type of a package, because it's not easy to own the market and buy it. And as soon as the market hears about it or gets a whiff of it, I think that you're going to see a very strong move up in the price. But I do think that it is something that will happen. I believe that that's something that will happen, and therefore my longer-term picture is very bullish. My near-term picture is a bit cloudy. I'm not yet convinced that we have finished with this base building action, this consolidation. It may yet take a few more months. It may yet see us go back to 550. But longer term, I believe that that's a place that we should look at, because it will move higher.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from line 307. You may ask your question. Our next question comes from line 289.
I have a question for Al Friedberg.
Yep.
Okay, my question is, in relation to your comment on commodities, I'm not sure you specifically mentioned uranium, but I just want to hear your views on where you feel the price of the major equity players in the uranium and also the copper game companies like Cameco, DHP Billiton, Techco-Minco. Where do you see their price moving as the commodity price decline that you anticipate moves forward? Are we looking at a near-term, say, 12 to 24-month reduction of 10, 20, 30%? Any views on that?
No, I don't have views on the commodity producers, and I have only some bear views on some of the commodities themselves. I don't have a clear picture in uranium. I'm not sure that we all know where the supplies of uranium are. It's difficult to quantify this market.
Right.
It is an over-the-counter market. It's not very transparent. So I can't. I've not traded it, and I've not participated at all in that market. And nor do I understand well the economics of the producer. So I don't have an opinion, and for the most part, by the way, when we want to express a bullish or a bearish view on a commodity like that, we would not go to the producers, to the shares. We would go to the commodity side. You know, it's more liquid, it's more focused, and it's more leveraged. So I can't give you a good opinion or any kind of opinion about the producers.
Thank you.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. Our next question comes from line 846.
I just pressed 1. I don't know whether that's me or not.
You're on the line. You can ask your question.
Yes. The grain market, there is a significant difference, say, in the soya complex as opposed to, let's say, corn, wheat, and barley, which, you know, do cross-substitute. Do you have a view on that situation?
No, but I think that you think to know a lot more than I do about about that grain market. My interest in grains was wheat. That's what it was in the past few months. And I was very, very taken by the supply demand, by the balance sheet that we were seeing in terms of world stocks in relation to usage. I thought that there would be an explosion in U.S. exports over the past 4 months. We have not seen that, and I'm surprised. And that's why the wheat market has been weakening, and we actually exited the position. But I don't have a view of what you're asking me. I'm sorry.
Our next question comes from line 230.
Al, you said something very interesting that I was wondering if you could sort of expand upon, and that was that Asian central banks may go into gold, but possibly go into strategic assets. And I was wondering if you could sort of mention a few of the strategic assets and how they would do such a thing.
Okay. I didn't have in mind anything specific. I only took some statements that were made, I think, by some officials that were close to the Bank of China, and maybe another one or two statements made by some other central bank in that region. And I would imagine that when they say strategic, they don't mean necessarily what we mean strategic. They may be talking about strategic for them. What is strategic for them is it may be different than what's strategic for us. And so I don't know whether they meant iridium and rhodium or whether they meant just oil. You know, so what's probably worthwhile to do is for somebody to study well the necessities, the industrial necessities of some of these Asian countries, and see what they're importing in large amounts and what they consider in what areas they consider themselves vulnerable to, and perhaps think in terms of buying those, because mm-hmm. that would be strategic for them.
Because the platinum has been, it's into the new high ground from the old 1980 high, and then palladium has a nice looking chart, so I was just wondering if those...
Right, and they may be, they may very well be strategic for them.
Yeah.
I think that you're onto something.
Our next question comes from line 289.
Question for Al. In view of your comments on the major currencies, the euro, US dollar, Canadian dollar, maybe even Deutsche Mark, I don't think you addressed that, but how would you recommend that a Canadian investor allocate his investments in terms of the currency weightings? But do you see with a 50% Canadian, 50% other, is there a recommended range?
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent question. Okay, the first thing is this. I think that when you're doing an investment in an asset that is not a money market asset, that is not a bond, it's not a money market, a treasury or a bond, but it's equity, shares, or it's real estate. I think that if you're doing an investment in equity and real estate, you don't necessarily have to be that concerned about the currency. In the long run, equity, this has been my theory, and I've done, you know, I've used this for the past 30 or 40 years. I feel that in the long run, asset prices, equity prices, real estate prices, do trade ultimately in that unit of value, which you may call like a U.S. dollar unit of value. In other words, there's an arbitrage in these world markets, and everything gets somehow priced in U.S. finally. So even if you invested in, Kenya, and the Kenyan, what is the Kenyan shilling? I think it's the Kenyan shilling. And the Kenyan shilling went down 85%, and you own some real estate or some shares in that country, chances are that the shares or the real estate, unless there's a revolution, unless there is a civil war and expropriation, chances are that those assets would maintain their dollar value. So when you're looking around to invest money, and my first suggestion is don't necessarily look at the currency exposure. I think that you look at the investment itself. It's different if you have a bond portfolio. It's different if you're looking just to make money from fixed income. There you have to be concerned much more about the currency. So my short advice to you, and it's free, by the way, so you know it was free advice, what it's worth. But my short advice is look at the investments that you want to buy. Don't think in terms of necessarily diversifying out of Canada as much as what can you get outside of Canada that you can get here as an equity investment or as real estate. Are the prices better? Are the values better? Are the metrics better? And if they are, don't be so concerned about the currency play or currency exposure.
Thank you.
Give you a partial answer?
A full answer. I was really looking at the fixed income side, the T-bills, like which country's T-bill should it be?
So that's a different question. That's a different question. And there, I think that you're becoming, in a way, a currency trader. When you do that, you actually become a currency trader, and that changes from week to week. So if I was in Canada and I had Canadian T-bills and Canadian bonds, I want to be out. I want to be in U.S. or I want to be in pounds or I want to be in other currencies because the Canadian dollar, as far as we are concerned, is still under pressure. But then you become much more of a trader. A currency trader, and then you have
to. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay. Albert, I think we'll let you get back to your day. I think this has been exceptional, and thank you for all the time that you put into this. And David, I'm going to thank you as well.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, we're
going to invite, you know, continued questions and continued interest. The Freeport Global Microphones are definitely open for business. So if you want, feel free to give me, Brad Cole, a call, or David Rothberg up in Toronto. And aside from that, again, I'm going to thank David and Albert and wish all of you a healthy and prosperous New Year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's presentation. You may now disconnect.